At BrunchRx, we make changemakers. Embark on the journey to creative leadership through the power of design thinking. We're building the next generation of innovators. So, me and Marie are collaborating to create a platform in which changemakers in the corporate and non-corporate environment can basically learn design thinking methodology to apply to their professional work.
Absolutely, and during this series we'll see how design thinking works and how you can make it work for you in your day-to-day life, wherever you're at right now.
And a little bit of background, I am primarily a graphic and interaction designer, and Marie is a product designer.
Yes, yeah. And as a Ryan, I've always loved making things, and like, especially working with materials, soft materials, wood, metal, fabric, and so on, and trying to put them together to make objects, and now spaces as well. And I'm as well interested in like the process of designing, which I would like to share with you.
Right. So BrunchRx is basically our collaboration to pull together the information that we share between us, to put it into a format which is useful for other people, specifically non-designers. We think that design is such a powerful tool, and often it's only used effectively by creative professionals, which is really a shame.
Like, if I may say, like, there's a book by Don Norman, and like, the thing is Design of the Everyday Things. And he's actually, in one of his articles, is saying that design is a too important thing to be left to designers. And I think that's great. Like, it's kind of shocking as a designer. You're like, okay, I'm going to lose my job or what's happening. But I think not at all. The opposite, that the more people are using design, the more like our society will be a better place.
Right. Right. And I think part of this process of bringing this knowledge to a broader audience requires that you need to sort of strip the word design of its current connotation. Because unfortunately, today, design but design has definitely become more mainstream than it was 15 years ago or 10 years ago.
Well, like many things. I think design is so wide environment. Like, you've got car design, fashion design, hair design,
right. Right,
or styling. So we get a bit lost. We're like, okay,
right.
What is design in the end?
Right. Yeah? And for me, the main problem with this situation is that all of these things that you listed, which I'm sure is sort of how the public perceives design, are primarily visual things.
Yes.
So you say, when you meet someone, you say, I'm a designer, and they immediately, you think of a guy in a black turtleneck who's snobby about typography or clothing or of some other sort of aesthetic kind of artifact. Whereas really design is a way of thinking, and it's a way of breaking down processes.
And I think like more precisely, it's a way of asking questions and finding answers.
Right.
And applying those answers in something that is useful for people.
Right.
Like, I think like, If I was to say that like a synonym of design thinking, for me is like human-centered design. It's really designing for people and not just to satisfy like industry or finance.
Or marketing.
As well, yeah.
So that basically brings us to our topic for the day, which is what is design thinking? So through this episode, we're basically going to try and break down the concept of design thinking into the process which is commonly used by designers and non-designers to arrive at design solutions. So this process has a few steps, which can be more or less clearly defined. So we're going to go through those steps, and we'll give you tips along the way for how you might implement and adapt this process to whatever problem you might be facing.
Yeah, and also I'd like to add that we did not invent this. it's a method that is used and proven. It has been developed, I think, in the beginning by IDEO in California, you know, the large design firm, a global design firm. It's in many books, like by Tim Brown, David, and Tom Kelly. So it's something that has been in the air, but we just want to help you to understand it and use it as well. So how do we start, like, with design thinking? I think, like, we were talking about human-centered design, so I would say, like, this is a key point, is the human, yeah?
Right, right. I think in any design process, ultimately, things are designed, processes are designed for people. So even if we're working in an industrial environment or we're designing a process that's going to be used within a company, the outcome basically always at some point comes back to a human. Even if we're designing a system for deploying code to a server, these processes are designed to accomplish that, but also to accommodate the human who is making decisions and controlling the system.
Yeah, that it shouldn't be like the people who are adjusting to the machines, but the opposite. Yeah.
Exactly. And we live in a really interesting age where, big data is the big buzzword now. But this is really, what this really means is that we're finally to a point where we're able to record enough information where we can observe behavior patterns in like a really broad way. So
that the question is like, what do we do with this data? And this behavior, like this, all this debate about design to change behavior. Is it even ethical? Like, do people really want to change their behavior? Can they do it? But I think it's really, really interesting.
Right. So that brings us basically to the first step, which is empathy. So empathy is a common word. You probably have heard it before, hopefully. But it basically means getting into the head of the person who's at the receiving end of whatever thing that you're creating.
And not just into the head, because like we say design thinking. So design thinking, there is some thinking, but it's also about making and about the physical environment. It's about this empathy stage is about following the user, maybe getting with them a full day and seeing what are they doing. Maybe it's not directly centered around your product, but you get more into their lives. It's about doing deeper interviews. There's also a bit of statistics, but of course you can use the big data, but I think it needs to be also in collaboration with some more personal gathering of information.
Right.
More emotional, I would say.
Right. For me, a big part of this empathy stage is being able to critically choose the right questions to ask. So let's say you're designing some process in your workplace where there's maybe two or three people which need to form some sort of pathway for information. So maybe it's like a hiring pipeline where someone is finding candidates, they pass them to another person who qualifies them, and then they pass them to a third person who is arranging interviews or something like this. So we could look at it from a purely sort of informational view. What information does each person at each stage need? But a better way to design that process would be actually to go and talk to those people and see how do they actually interact with the IT systems which you would be creating. Do they work more efficiently in email, or is it something which could be through some other channel? So it's really critical to ask the right questions and to really be critical in the way that you sort of observe a situation in order to get to the bottom of to get the real answer to a problem.
Yeah, I think the term right question can be a bit tricky because they're okay, if there's right, there is wrong. Right. Yeah. So I think what's important is to ask a question which will be interesting enough. When you talk about asking the right question or finding the right answer, I think it's a little bit biased, or that I don't know if there is really a right question or wrong question, but I think it's more a matter of defining a point of view that will be exciting. That's something that will really sustain your interest throughout the whole project. If you say, okay, I'm just going to as I said, to make a better email, okay,
right.
I'm not thrilled, yeah? But if I say, okay, how might we enhance communication between a hiring person and some potential candidates, because we really want to find the gem, the best new addition to our team, I think we are getting somewhere. There are many examples, and do you have some other example how we could reformulate this thing? You were talking about the
problem
process
to solve.
Yes.
Maybe it's creating a piece of software, or maybe it's even reorganizing a renovation of your office building.
No.
If you're restructuring maybe the positioning of offices or of departments throughout a building.
So you wouldn't say what color are we going to paint the walls, but how can we make our employees more creative and use the space for that?
Right.
So, like, starting by this problem. And then once you have this question, of course, you can reformulate it. Yeah, I think that this question is not something that is set in stone. That, of course, you can go back to the information gathered about your users at any time. And many people think, like, user research is something you do at the beginning and then it ends, you know. But I think on the opposite is something that should be all along the project and that you can refer to, or depending on your new developments, you can go and ask new questions. Once you have this question or a satisfying question, like, what do you do with it? Like, questions are nice, but at some point you might want some answers or some solutions.
Right.
So it brings us to the ideation stage.
Right.
How would you define this, Ryan?
Yeah, so ideation is basically where you take all the information you've gathered and you sort of synthesize it into possible solutions. And for me, this is like a really sort of critical step in the whole process. It's kind of the soul of the creative process, I guess. Yeah. You could say. And because of that, it tends to be a really dynamic, quickly changing part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also the part of the process which is the most vulnerable to unintentional sabotage. Really the hardest thing, me and Marie are both design teachers, so we're teaching in university level, teaching design to design students, basically. And for me, one of the hardest things to get students to do is to switch off the immediate judgment that they've basically been conditioned to have their entire, 20 years of life or whatever.
Well, it's like we come back to this right answers or
exactly.
Wrong answers, and to say, okay, I've got this question and I want to make the perfect solution for it.
Right.
When actually this idea generation process can be quite ugly.
Like, exactly.
It's not perfect at all. Yeah?
No. It's not perfect, and it is perfect. Because I think defining, even to say the word perfect actually already is painting the wrong sort of picture.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that basically in most school systems, the way that we're taught is basically that there's this linear thought process. You know, so a linear thought process makes sense in math or in science, where to get to a correct assumption, point C, both point A and point B must also be correct. But in creativity and in design thinking, basically, you can get to a correct endpoint through complete nonsense.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the most interesting results do come from complete nonsense. And so it's basically... the skill to develop is basically to suspend judgment until you have sufficient background and sufficient development to actually assess if a solution is a good solution or not.
And I think, like, this brings us also to the fact that idea generation can be something like individual, but it works best when it's done in a team.
Right.
When it's like collaborative design or participative design, and then like suspend judgment on the ideas of others is super important, but also knowing how to give feedback in a way that is constructive.
Right.
And also building on the ideas of others, not saying, okay, I'm the owner of this idea, don't touch.
Right.
But this is interesting, what can we do with that?
Exactly.
How can we make it better?
Exactly.
And that there is no idea that is totally useless.
Right.
But it can always bring us to some other point.
Exactly. So there's a few techniques that are really kind of general. There's a mind mapping technique where you basically, it's maybe more useful for graphic design specifically, but basically random word association, where you start with a seed word in the center of a page, and then you basically branch off, creating a big sort of spidergram, a spider web, but diagram of kind of random word associations, yeah, which you then later pick through for interesting key ideas.
Yeah. What I really like a method that I really like is the post-it method, where you go back to your defined point of view or problem, and as a group, you all propose ideas. And each time, like, somebody has an idea, just write it on a post-it and put it on the wall. And then you have an overview of all the solutions, and you can see if there are clusters or, like, areas which are more valid, like, which are... in which we are more interested in,
right,
or which have more potential.
Right.
And it has the advantage for me that it's also quite visual. It's not just like talking in the air,
right,
but
each
idea has a physical element to it.
Right.
And it can be both like in words or in sketches.
Right. Right. And I think one of the big themes through all these different brainstorming techniques is the introduction of some sort of pattern-breaking mechanism. So whether it's controlled randomness or whether it's the input of a large group, basically the idea is to break out of all of the preconceived kind of solution patterns which you have, which you've been exposed to for your whole life. You know, so if we're trying to design a new chair, we've seen so many different chairs that you automatically assume sort of a basic form. So that actually is a hindrance when you're trying to come up with a unique solution to a problem.
Yeah, and like maybe you shouldn't say you're designing a new chair, but you're designing something like to sit on, or just something comfortable for people to have a conversation
right.
together.
Exactly. So that even just reframing the problem in a different way can help you already to kind of break free of these preconceived patterns.
Yes, and then I think we shouldn't stay too long on the idea generation. I agree that it's super important for you and it's a very key point. It can be, as you said, it's quite fragile point, and also maybe because people are not so confident with that, they're saying, okay, you have to be a designer to have ideas.
Right.
Which is not true at all.
No. Actually, I know a lot of designers with horrible ideas.
And the opposite is true, of course. I say many politicians have amazing ideas. It depends who. I think now we've been talking a lot about ideas, but the key thing is what do you do with those ideas? How do you make them come to life?
Right. Right. And so moving from the brainstorming phase to the next phase, which would be prototyping or experimentation, is... for me, a lot of times, sort of the hardest step, because you get really enthralled in this brainstorming process, and you get really in the groove of just creating, you know, millions of different variations and millions of different ideas, and then suddenly you have to switch into editorial mode and be able to look at all of the crap that you just created and select out the things which have some sort of potential.
Yes, and of course, you select them regarding to the previous step, if they fit more with the problem or with the info you've gathered from the users, or something, sometimes just because they seem interesting to you and fun, and you don't necessarily see exactly what is it going to lead you to, but it sounds like a nice adventure.
Right. I think that's a key too as well. So in brainstorming, you have to suspend judgment, but also in selecting ideas, there's also still an element of suspended judgment, because you also have to let yourself try things which aren't immediately, which don't seem immediately feasible.
Yeah, and I think when you make this prototype, this is when you can test it.
Exactly.
And actually see if you can go forward.
Right.
And so, it's also very useful for communicating your ideas, actually, because once it becomes tangible...
then you can talk about it.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And this in visual design, this is really key, because a lot of times you'll have an idea which sounds amazing, and then once you try sketching it out, you realize that it doesn't work at all in visual form. And so this prototyping stage is where you're basically taking your strong ideas, ideas you think might have potential, and testing them out in some way. So
what's important maybe to say is that prototyping is not just for physical products.
Right.
Yeah, you talk now about visual design as well, but we could imagine prototyping a service. In the form of role playing or doing a video that would introduce a scenario.
Right.
Just to find a way to share the idea in a way that is easy to understand, that is attractive, and where people can actually comment and feedback on some concrete elements.
Exactly. So a lot of times these prototypes will be sort of low fidelity versions of a final thing. So in the software development world, there's this concept of agile software development, where you basically take your big idea for this giant piece of software and you boil it down to its very minimum component, and then you just put it out there and you kind of see what the reaction is. Because a lot of times what you experience when you see people actually using your prototype, you see that there's some potential which you never imagined.
Yeah, and you put yourself in the place of a learner and not of a teacher.
Exactly.
No, you're not imposing your creation to people, but
right.
You're trying to get... their feelings about it and see how you can make it better.
Right.
I think it brings us also to the values of prototypes or models, mockups. That one side is making the look and feel. So I think this is the first idea that comes for us when you say prototype. It should be like the perfect thing, like shiny, perfect colors that really looks like the real thing. But that's only one aspect. There's also the fact that the implementation, which is about finding the context for defining the context for this object or service. So again, as I said, it could be this role playing or storytelling around it, and then of course the materials, the making, and so on. So, but all this doesn't have to be like fixed into one model, but it can be a succession of models or different medias that will inform your design.
Right, and the key is really to keep these prototypes easy enough to produce that there's not a big burden in iteration. So if you're, you know, if we're using the example of creating a physical product, this would mean probably using the simplest material possible. So maybe it's a block of foam, which you carve with an X-Acto.
Or even like cardboard and paper.
Right.
Really. And I think like it's quite key as well to not fall in love with your prototype. I can really spend a lot of time to polish those radiuses, but in the end, it doesn't tell you anything about the function of the object.
No, and then you run the risk of putting in dozens of hours working on a prototype that doesn't work at all.
And then you don't want to change it anymore because it's too late, or you run out of money,
or you're too attached to it.
Yes.
My instructors always had this great metaphor, which they would use with relish in our design classes, which was throw the baby out of the boat. It's time to throw the baby out of the boat, Ryan.
Yeah, this is a time when you have to make decisions as well. And I think, again, like you don't make these decisions alone, but you co-decide with the users.
Right.
This is, again, like once you have a prototype, as I say, it's easier to test it.
Right.
To continue this user experience research, to invite in people. Maybe there are people like from the street, or maybe it's your mother, or whoever. Like, can be people who have never heard about this product or service, or on the opposite, some extreme users who will really go to the point and tell you if the thing works or not.
Right. So right now we're talking about physical prototypes, things which you would physically test. But this can also be true for processes. So if we're, for instance, designing some new process within a business, you can also create like a small scale kind of model of this process. So instead of hiring some, software development company to build some really custom tool, see what you can do with a spreadsheet, or see what you can do with Google Docs. If you're just prototyping a new workflow, use the simplest tools, use the fastest way to get to a workable, version of this idea. So don't think that you have to put a lot of resources into developing prototypes. They can be really low fidelity in the beginning.
Yeah, and I think it's also about having the confidence to just start.
To try, and to not be afraid to fail, and to view failure as a learning experience and not as something to be avoided.
Absolutely. And like I think this brings us to our last point, which is about creating a constructive atmosphere for all this process to happen, like what do you think, Ryan? Like in a company, how would you encourage the birth of new ideas, this testing, empathy, and all that?
I think that's really independent, specific to different companies, depending on how large or what the structure, decision making structure is.
Yep.
But I think the key is to value input from people at all levels of the company.
Yeah.
So if we're trying to make a decision about some direction that the company is going to go, and you really want honest input from people, you need to be able to ask everyone to participate. So this means everyone from interns to senior management. No one should feel like their opinion's not valuable. So everyone needs to have a chance to give their ideas in a way that they don't feel is going to be threatening their career or their social standing in a group of people.
And maybe it's also about asking or going out of the company sometime, just having a break and doing something totally different. I don't know if it would be running or having an art class or whatever comes to your mind, but thinking like work is not the end of everything. And then sometimes like the best ideas for service or products can happen anywhere, but you need to be prepared for that.
Right, you know? Right. And being prepared means just having an open mind and being willing to accept answers at strange times or in strange places. So don't think that this process is only at work when you're sitting behind your computer at the office or when you're in a meeting with colleagues. This is something which takes place in sort of lifetime. So, you know, you can have an idea for a solution when you're laying in bed or when you're in the shower. And actually, those are really common places. Yeah. That people have ideas, but
and I think like in the future installments of this podcast, we will also explore those techniques and tips, and some like might work for a lot of people, some might work only for you. Ultimately, you might come up with your own processes, which I think is great, and that's the best. Yeah.
Definitely.
And so we will explore that. So, what's the takeaway for today? Is like the key steps of design thinking process. It all starts with empathy, with understanding the user for whom you're actually designing your design for. And then once you know a little bit more about their needs, you're defining a point of view or a question or design question that you will try to solve. This brings us to idea generation, so proposing solutions without, like as we said, without judgments, that you really have to be open to whatever presents itself. And then you'll select some ideas to prototype them, test them, and start implementing them. And finally, all this process is working best when you have a constructive atmosphere, and that's something that we'll develop in the next podcast.
Definitely. So this is the first in the series of design thinking. We hope you've enjoyed it. In future installments, we'll be going into more detail on each of these steps, giving you workable tips, things that you can implement in your professional life.
And also, like, we'll interview people who are going to share with us, like, how they use this process and how they create their own processes as well for more creative solutions in their company and in their day-to-day life.
Right. So that's it for now. We hope you've enjoyed the very first in the series of Design Thinking podcast from Brunchworks. So if you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to rate us on iTunes. We have exactly 0 ratings right now because it's the very first in the series. So we hope you'll be the first. So you can learn more at brunchworks.co. Thanks for your time and have a productive day.